Hello, friends. Welcome to episode three of Chris Chambers Noir. Chris is an amazing author. His books are gritty and powerful, and his prose are magical. So you must pick this up. And today's guest is fantastic Krista Faust. She is in LA. We are over here on the East Coast in DC. So we're excited to sort of bring together what's happening East West and just launch into this podcast. But first, I want to tell you a little bit about Krista. A native of New York City, she grew up in the Bronx and Hell's Kitchen. Krista has been making stuff up her whole life, she says, and spent most of her teen years on endless subway rides, cutting school, and scribbling stories. When she turned 18, she worked in the Times Square peep booths and later as a fetish model and professional dominatrix. So cool. Tell us more. She told her first story when she moved to LA in the early 90s. After nearly 30 years in her beloved adopted city, she is currently living out her third act in the Pacific Northwest. So you're not in LA, you're in the Pacific Northwest.
I am in the Pacific Northwest, West
Okay.
Coast, but up
But
high as
still, a
opposed
little
to
further
down
north.
low.
She's an unapologetic pervert and a complicated queer, a film noir enthusiast and menopausal troublemaker. Krista writes primarily crime fiction, but also graphic novels and work-for-hire media tie-in novels. She doesn't plan to stop anytime soon, and we can't wait to hear more about this magic. All right, Chris, take it away.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And I am honored and excited to talk to Krista. Episode two is Gary Phillips. So that was a rolling, raucous, fun time. But we learned something. We learned a lot of stuff. Yes, I'm going to talk about that too. And I'm going to talk about this, but in a more academic setting. So and don't worry, it'll be
Ooh,
reversed.
well
The killing joke. Don't worry.
then.
But no,
Are we academic? Is that what we're doing now?
Yeah, well, we're going to start off a little academic, then we're going to get perverted. But what I like to do is do like a quick icebreaker, one perverted and one fairly normal and mundane. Here's the perverted one. Okay, not really perverted, but I'm not a shrinking violet. I'm an older guy who's had a lot of background stuff, done a lot of weird stuff in my life. And I met you at BoucherCon in St. Petersburg. BoucherCon, the World Mystery Conference, which we just had in New Orleans, and Krista was there. And we had breakfast one day, and I had never thought about in my life about feet before. Okay, you see where this is going. Never thought about feet. When I was, I think my mother trained me with manners. I'm talking, when I look at a woman, I look in her eyes. I don't look at her chest or her ass, okay? But I never thought about feet until I met you and you were talking about feet. And then I started to, you basically ruined me because now I get very self-conscious about feet, especially in the summertime, especially in a place like DC where it's hot most of the time. And then, I just can't look at anybody's feet because I don't want to look too closely because you've ruined me. Because you've talked about, the foot fetishes and this and that. I mean, I always knew about Quentin Tarantino and how wacky he is, with feet in movies. But you just ruined me about feet. And I'm always self-conscious about feet. And I blame you for putting that in my brain. Now I can't, I look away. And I know there are so many great feet out there. I was, in New Orleans, even though the pavement was dirty, there were a lot of feet out there, a lot of sandals, flip-flops, but I can't
Oh,
look. So
I
that's your
see.
fault, and I want you to own up to that and apologize to me for
No,
ruining
see,
me.
that's a you problem. Okay, that's not a me problem. All right, because here's the thing about any kind of fetish. People can have fetishes for, I mean, one from column A, one from column B. You could pick almost anything, and there's somebody out there who sexualizes that specific thing. So if you're self-conscious about feet, clearly that indicates that you have an attraction that you should deal with. And
Well,
that
then
is, I feel like it
you
was a
awakened
good
it in me
choice.
then, if that's the case. I don't think
No,
it's the case, but let's
I
say for the
don't
sake of
think
argument, it is.
I could not implant a foot fetish or an interest in feet in somebody who genuinely doesn't like them. So clearly that was already there, and I just allowed that side of you to come out. So no apology.
Okay. All right. Well, we got that done. Okay. She won't help me out there. I'm gonna have to get some Tarantino therapy then. You're probably right, but hey, I figured I'd fish. Okay. Now, more mundane icebreaker. On social media, you're doing a noir movie a day kind of calendar for November. I was really. My wife likes the one that you had up there for Detour with Anne Savage and Tom Neal, where she's telling him to shut the fuck up, where she's gonna slap the crap out of him.
Oh,
And
yeah.
I looked at the date; it's like 1945. I'm like, the codes were still in, you know. How did that stuff? That's a fascinating thing. Tell us more about, you know, this calendar and what you're doing on that.
Well, it's actually not. I didn't initiate it. It's a fellow social media user who goes by Lady K Designs, and she does this every year, where she, gives us all a series of prompts for us to, kind of use as a lens to think about, what attracts us or what we like or enjoy in the genre of noir. And I would argue that the kind of top 10 list concept is very restrictive because what might be on my top 10, you might not be interested in, vice versa. So this gives people like a more personalized way to talk about, well, I like this or I like that. And I think that as far as the code, the
Ace code, whatever.
traditional
Yeah.
movie code from back in the day, it made people more creative. It made writers more creative. It made actors more creative because they had to find ways around, these coming straight out and saying things. And a great example of that would be Gilda, which is, it is a movie about fucking.
Right.
I mean, that's what it's about. It's about sex. It's about attraction. It's about lust and denial. And you can beat around the bush, so to speak,
So to speak,
all you
yes.
want, but that's really what that story is about. It's about desire and what
Right.
happens when desire gets curdled and thwarted. And I would also argue that that is like the best bisexual noir of all time, because there is
Wow.
clearly a very powerful triangle going on between, the three characters there.
Right.
So, you can address things in these kind of bank shot ways without just coming straight out and saying it.
Well, you know, given the time period, now immediate post-war was actually historically and culturally kind of a little tiny slither of liberalism before, you know, you went to the Cold War and McCarthyism. But even so, it would seem to me that a woman talking to a man that way would probably be more subversive on film than a pair of tits, don't you think?
In
I
some
mean,
ways,
because.
yes, but in other ways, it's kind of almost the femme fatale archetype is almost reinforcing patriarchal ideas about women who step out of those traditional roles. So yes, they are allowed to step out, but they have to die at the end. They have to be
Right, they're
punished,
punished,
like
yeah.
too late for tears, or I mean, any number of examples that you can give. Like, yes, women were allowed to speak like that and act like that, but they had to suffer the consequences at the end, in the same way that there was this requirement that crime can't pay.
Hey,
You
yeah.
can't get away with a crime.
And that was
And there,
directly in the code, right?
exactly, and I
Yeah.
would argue that subverting the traditional available roles for a woman in society is criminal, and a woman cannot be allowed to get away with that.
Right. Well, we're going to talk about that a little bit, tiny bit, tiny, tiny bit later. But let me ask you this. Just going into your work, I mean, that whole Angel Deer series was crazy. I loved it. Money Shot. I love Chokehold. I love Get Off. But let's get academic here. And we're going to talk about the anthology with John Cooperheaver in a minute. But can you academically, I don't mean boringly, Okay, because I know you ain't born. But can you academically kind of walk us through very briefly what is the difference between pulp and noir? Because a lot of people can't get a handle on that, and a lot of people have a lot of different definitions of that. Gary and I struggled. You know, you'd think we would fucking know, but you know, we were like, ugh, I chalked it up to senility or not us not taking our blood pressure medicine. But I mean, can you clarify that?
I mean, I can only tell you what I think. I mean, I don't have any kind of, you know, credentials to say I know and you don't. But the way I see it is that pulp and noir are kind of a Venn diagram, and they can overlap, but they don't always. You know? So there are certain types of pulp writing, like, for example, some of the you know, pulp heroes, like, or anti-heroes, like the Spider, or even the Shadow, or, you know, like there was a lot of those types of kind of fun, pulpy, two-fisted stories that were not noir because they were reinforcing the status quo in that there would be a criminal and then the pulp hero would swing in and restore order.
Literally and swing in sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And they would do that again and again, you know, with different villains. Or maybe there's an arch villain or whatever. But the idea was that it was very much focused on action. And I don't think noir at its heart is about action, because I say this a lot when it comes to separating the traditional mystery from noir, which is that noir is not a whodunit, it's a whydunit, you know, and it isn't about the heist itself. An action story would be about the heist. It would be about the cool things that happen and they're punching guys and running and shooting guns. That's the action aspect. But what noir really digs into is how the people involved in the heist fall apart in the aftermath. Right. That's what makes it noir. And I guess the clearest way to define those two categories, pulp and noir, is pulp is plot and noir is character. But they can overlap and do overlap.
Well, I'm going to hold this up, the Killing Joke, from that you did in collaboration with Mr. Gary Phillips. Amazing adaptive work here, you know, for DC Comics. And this was based on the original, I think it was story. It was actually an award-winning cartoon, I think. Animation.
Well, it was animation, but it started as a graphic novel.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's right. So you guys did the novel here. And that's why I was setting up with that question, because it's that weird interplay, that Venn diagram meeting between pulp and noir. It doesn't seem to matter what the media is. It can be a graphic novel. It can be a novelization, prose. It can be an animation or a feature film. What I'm getting at is this, is this something that should be used more as a tool in entertainment? Because it is such an amazing tool when pulp and hard-boiled noir come together. And it doesn't matter whether it's a movie, a cartoon, a graphic novel, or a, you know, novelization or a collection of short stories. I mean, do you think that, you know, here's a $1 million question now. I'm not going to beat around the bush, so to speak, here, even though I do sometimes. Do you think we're getting a short shrift here? And I'm going to set it up for you one more time, because I'm going to make some enemies here. Do you think that this concentration in the business now, the business that's pushing things towards this label of thriller and suspense, and we talked about this, Gary and I went on and on about this, and what's propulsive writing, and we want the new Gone Girl and stuff like that. Do you think that business pressure is ignoring the amazing creative tool that hard-boiled noir and pulp pushed together can make? Because it seems to be that's the thing. You know, we're definitely not the flavor noir or the flavor of the day. Sorry, wrong French, but go ahead.
Well, obviously, my dog Lupe has opinions. on that. She's got some barks that she'd like to share with us.
Right. I'm glad she agrees.
I feel like that's an artificial construct, in my opinion, because what is more propulsive than pulp? I mean, you know, if you look at, I mean, I consider the Angel Dare trilogy to be kind of a thriller pulp noir hybrid, because right. It is very propulsive, right. You know, and it does pull the reader through very kind of fast changing environments and
you're right.
Action sequences. So I don't think that those two things are completely separate, but I do think in a certain way that there is an unconscious gendering of certain types of stories, in that there is an idea that action is inherently male and character development is inherently female, or that you can write a gendered thriller, which is either about, you know, a girl on the train or a girl in whatever environment, which is geared towards women, or you could write like a spy thriller, you know, which is, or a military thriller, which would be more geared towards what's perceived as a masculine readership. And so I feel like there are forces that would like to box things in from the outside, you know, because they want to know where to put it in the bookstore. They want to know how to sell things. They want to know what the comps are. They want to know what it's similar to that's already been successful. But as a reader, I don't feel like those distinctions are all that useful. And they can, and in my opinion, should be permeable. And the most interesting books for me as a reader are the ones that live in that sort of liminal borderland between genres.
Right. Yeah, I just was curious what you're, I mean, I ask everybody this because there is this drive to compartmentalize, and you know, and you see the rise of international thriller writers versus kind of the older, you know, stuff like MWA, which I'm involved in. I mean, I'm president of our chapter here in DC, Maryland, and Virginia, but you know, I'm probably one of the younger people in the chapter. And then you got, you know, all the young cool people who are writing propulsive stuff, you know, including, you know, you think, you know, military stuff, you know, who want to be called thriller writers. Now everything's a thriller. And, you know, the common denominator there, it seems, and I'm glad you put your finger on it. Some of these works don't really, the character really doesn't matter almost. It's almost, you've got some tropes and some stereotypes, and then it's page turner. And you know, I wish people would look more to what we're doing, because you know, and again, we're actually closer, I would guess, and I don't know what your opinion is, to the original, I would say, three legs on the chair of mysteries, from going back to Edgar Allan Poe or who else. It was basically what, police procedurals, hard-boiled noir, and cozies. Those were the three prongs. And I think
I would argue
you disagree? I mean, go ahead.
Not that I would disagree, but I would not necessarily lump hard-boiled and noir into the same category, because they can be very different. They have different goals. You know, like, right. in my opinion, hard-boiled leans a little bit more towards the pulp hero end of the spectrum, where, like, I mean, even with something like Batman, right? That's right. A continuing character. You can't kill him. You know, he can't end up sucking gas in San Quentin because of a bad woman who did him wrong. That's never going to happen in a Batman story, because you already know that this character has to continue. And you could make the same argument for, you know, like Philip Marlowe or right. any other hard-boiled detective character. There's an expectation that, you know, they move among bad, dangerous situations, but they walk between the raindrops. It doesn't affect them. You know, and I think that with noir, it would be almost impossible to have an ongoing noir series, because the whole point of noir is the downward spiral, and you can only go down so far before you hit the bottom. Yeah. So I think those two are cousins, but not identical twins.
But wouldn't you say that within those that interplay there between noir and hard boiled, a common denominator might be that there aren't any easy answers or happy endings? I mean, would you say that? I mean, or is that too general too?
It would also depend on what you define as a happy ending, you know, because I think that for people who have lived very comfortable, privileged lives, the return to order is a happy ending. But for those of us who are marginalized or who are experiencing the world around us in ways that oppress who we really are, we don't necessarily look for a return to order. We want to maybe break it open and try something different. So I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm just being, you know, a contrarian, but in a lot of ways, I feel like it's just not so easy to block things off this way and say, this is this way and this is that way.
Right.
It's all kind of, you know, interchangeable.
Fluid.
It's fluid, kind of like me.
Okay. You know? Well, this is a good segue then. Tell us about the anthology with John Cooper Aver. I mean, definitely Flash the Book.
Flashing.
Flash the Book.
We are flashing.
Crime Egg. Yes, we love to flash. Your story in there, tell us about that. And then tell us, you know, what did you dig? Did you have to dig down deep, or was it an easy, burden to, you know, or what was the process there?
Well, it's a very different voice for me. This was a character that just sort of birthed himself sort of whole in my mind and is very, very different from any previous character that I've written in terms of...
It's a queer character, just to be clear to the audience.
Yes, it's a complicated a queer character, or a male character. And so it wasn't so much the issue of writing a male character as it was, you know, writing a character who thinks and speaks very differently than I do, you know, who lives in another time period and has a very different internal voice than I do. So that was the thing that was the most challenging for me. And then also, just to back up a little bit for people who don't know about this book, it's stories that are inspired by famous queer icons in history. And the icon can be a character in the story, or they could just be an inspiration. They could just be a jumping off point or something about them that initiates this storytelling. And it's like just wildly, wildly different choices that people are. It's like James Baldwin and like the Babadook.
Yeah.
You know, like it couldn't be more wide and wide ranging and fun. But for me, the icon that I chose was James Whale.
Okay.
Who I don't know if you've probably seen the film version Gods and Monsters.
Yeah.
But this is a famous gay icon about whom an incredibly well done story has already been told. So those are big shoes to fill.
Yeah, I was about to say. I mean, because that movie with Brendan Fraser and who played James Whale? I'm having an old man.
Ian
moment.
McKellen.
Ian McKellen. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't take my melatonin last night. I didn't sleep.
No, listen.
That.
Oatmeal.
Yeah, I know. The gray hair is bad. You know, it's bad and good, and it's bad. But it's I mean, I was going to say. I mean, you know, you really, you know, had to get up and meet a challenge because you had that film and you had a lot of background material, and so You know, I think you knocked it out of the park, but yeah, but you definitely left a you challenged yourself, you know.
Yeah, well,
but
I
why
mean,
did you pick why'd you pick whale?
well, for
I mean,
one thing,
just because.
I love Bride of Frankenstein. Bride of Frankenstein is you know one of those films that you know you saw it when you were a kid, and it just it reads so queer. It's like one of the all-time queerest classic monster movies, and
But Elsa Lanchester queer
that's
also,
right.
or
Yes,
yeah.
my point exactly.
Yeah,
You know, I
yeah.
mean, pretty much everybody in that film or making it was
Was gay or was
in
queer.
some
Right,
way or another
right.
kind of fluid. But
Right.
yeah, the reason why I wanted to choose him is because I saw a lot of historical parallels between now and me at my age, now having lived through what I lived through when I was younger, and Whale and his life, and what he had lived through when he was younger, and what it feels like to be a queer elder who experienced a time of openness, a time when you kind of felt like we won, right? Like there's an IKEA ad with two guys trying to, you know, buy a dining room table. Like, you know, House Hunters has got a lesbian polycule buying a house
Right.
together. It's like, we're good. We did it. You know, gay marriage is legal,
And then
right? We
kaboom.
won, right?
Yeah, right.
And then now, you know, in the same way as in the 1930s, the late 20s and 30s, there was a kind of vibrant, open, creative gay scene in movies and music, and it was much more accepted and open. And after the war, you started to get situations like the Lavender Scare, for
Right.
example, where at the same time as the government was cracking down on what it perceived as communism, it was also running a parallel shadow battle against people who were perceived to be vulnerable to blackmail. That the
Yes.
thought was that if you're gay, then you're ashamed, or you should be ashamed. And if you're doing something that you're ashamed of, then the enemies of America can use that
Right.
against us. And so that was the excuse that was made to, you know, persecute a lot of people in various government jobs at the time. But I guess looking at the world now and looking at how so many things that felt really open and acceptable when I was a young adult, you know, coming into middle age, that now I'm seeing that table turn again. And it really got me thinking. And I don't know if all the listeners know this, but James Whale did actually commit suicide and suffered from terrible depression. And I think a lot of what led to that was his kind of feeling of isolation from the world and the loss of that idyllic open life when he was younger. And that was what made me choose him, because I wanted to talk about how even if you don't win a battle, it's still worth fighting. I think
Right.
that's really the main takeaway from that story for me.
Well, yeah, I mean, 'cause there's also the subtext, and this is in the, you know, quite frankly, in the film too, that there's a you know, there are creatives out there, very powerful creatives, who want to wall that off. I mean,
Absolutely.
who you know, I mean, the term closeted is, you know, I think kind of hackneyed, but I mean, in this kind of either virtual closetness or physical kind of a thing, walling that off and not wanting to deal with that, and even, you know, kind of acting like the enemy, you know, as camouflage. You
Yeah.
know, that is you know, are you seeing that as a theme, since we seem to be going back into a cycle now? I mean, among creatives, what are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it's one of the places where I'm seeing it in the scariest and most stark light is with my trans friends and family, you know, where people are really genuinely afraid for their lives and wondering, should I disguise my transition? You know, should I try to pass myself off as a different gender just until this goes away? And I mean, that's just even saying that is so heartbreaking.
Yeah.
But the fact that that's how dire our situation is right now, you know, that people are thinking like, maybe I shouldn't dress so butch. Maybe I should try to wear lipstick, or, you know, maybe I should spend more time with, you know, people who are more traditionally gender appropriate. And so it's terrifying to me as a 56-year-old person with kind of a fluid attitude towards gender, that when I was a kid, I thought of the closet as one way. It's one
right.
way, right? Like you come out and now you're out and that's it. And the idea that it might suck you back in is just existentially terrifying. And I know I'm not alone in that, because I'm hearing this from so many people around me, friends and family. And, you know, these are some very, very scary times. And that's what I wanted to talk about in
right.
my story in Crime Inc.
Do you think that that's, I mean, just not just queer writers in our genre, but everyone, do you think that's a good, you know, thing to tap into in terms of plot or character development? Is that kind of a you know, pulling back in kind of a thing? Because, you know, it's things have gotten so weird now that now you have some people having like gay tropes. You know, I mean, they're definitely stereotypes, but, you know, that to spice up the story, the femme fatale might be a gay man, you know, or something who's got a little crooked edge to him or something like that, you know, and it's just window dressing. But do you think it's that these kinds of, you know, almost introspective and fearful kinds of things, do you think those are good things to tap into?
Well, part of the purpose of this anthology was that we really wanted to highlight queer voices and queer stories, you know,
right,
where these are not like straight stories where there's a queer sidekick, or, you know, like the equivalent would be like the Magical Negro,
right,
like Stephen King's
yeah,
story,
exactly.
You know, where like it's really about the white people, but
right.
Like here's this magical alien person who bestows wisdom upon the real characters, you know. And I think I made this comment in an earlier interview, but, you know, I really wanted to see more stories that don't view gay characters as these kind of sparkly, you know, unicorns that just show up in the lives of straight people and make them more glamorous with a makeover. You know, or, you know, it's in a weird way, I think that almost makes people feel more safe, because
right.
like the nice TV makeover guy who's going to come in and show you how to, you know, put together a glamorous outfit, you don't want to think about like the rest of his life.
Yeah, when
you know,
he leaves.
Like,
yeah.
It's like it's kind of like I was saying, it's the manic pixie dream gaze, you know, where like their purpose is not to have an inner life,
right,
or to be sexual, or to be messy, or, you know, to make mistakes, or just be like a regular fallible character. Their purpose is to be this like shining bastion of their minority, you know, in order to show all the straight characters like, see, we are good.
Right. Yeah. It's weird. It was interesting because author K.T. Nguyen and I were talking about domestic suspense, which she definitely fights that label off. But we were talking about it in terms of that, you know, it, there also seems to be in some of those stories, a magic Negro who's usually another female, like, you know, her friend,
the who's best infinite, friend. Yeah.
Yeah, black friend who's like so hip and so wise and so strong until it says, look, girl, you know, I don't think your boyfriend or your husband are trying to kill you. I think it's the guy who works at CVS. And then the guy at CVS kills her. You know, she don't last to the end of the story or the movie.
Exactly.
Yeah. And you know, it's amazing like that. And, you know, and then Sean Cosby, and everybody should know who Sean Cosby is, say Cosby, a long time ago had said, you know, we're looking at transitions of or transformations of the mystery genre by queer writers, by people of color. It's almost like it can be, it's almost akin to the sidekick or the trope now pushing the former, you know, leading man or woman aside and taking center stage and taking, you know, agency and everything. So it's, you know, it's amazing stuff.
Exactly. You know? And I would even go so far as to say that, like, my dream it for us in the genre is I want to see more bad gays. Where are the bad gays? I want people who are dumb, people who fuck up, people who are shallow or vain or petty, not supernatural villains, but just ordinary flawed people who make bad decisions. I mean, what I love about noir as a genre is that you get this kind of, and it usually is a man, every man character who is an ordinary Joe who's just trying to make it through his day. And, you know, he makes one bad decision.
Yep.
You know, he just steals money, or he has an affair, or he does some small thing, you know, and then everything goes to hell in a handbasket. And to be able to be for that quote unquote every man to be queer or black or Asian or trans or anything other than a straight white guy.
Right.
And to be fallible, to not have to be a shining example of our minority, you know, but to just kind of be a fuck up. You know,
yeah.
That's what I liked about Bathhouse.
Right.
It was Pete Vernon, PJ Vernon.
I think it was PG. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not remembering the name. I apologize if I'm getting it wrong. But like, that's another great example where it's a story that has fallible, ordinary people in situations where they don't make good choices, you know, and they're not there yelling at the straight person to do the right thing. They're the ones making the mistakes.
Right.
And I want to see more of that.
Well, please flash the book and give the title again, the collection.
Here it is. It is called Crime, Inc. Iconic.
Yes.
And it's edited by John Copenhaver and Salem West.
Yes, John is a great, great, great guy. He is a great, great guy. Now, let me switch gears here. I was wondering if you had little Mads Mikkelsen handy. Anatomically correct little Mads Mikkelsen.
Well, he is not currently strapped.
Oh, he's not?
He is not currently strapped. So he has got his cannon crotch at the moment.
Oh, he does? Oh, that's too bad. Oh,
but he is still handcuffed, which is...
He's still handcuffed. What? No, should be. You know, that guy is, you're talking about iconic in terms of, you know, adaption. Yeah. Oh, look at that. Good Lord. That is a great doll.
This is his tracksuit.
He's in a tracksuit. He's now old enough to be an unk, as we say. So he can wear a tracksuit now.
Oh, yeah.
He's entitled and some sensible shoes. But he is a great actor in our genre, in our, you know, entertainment genre of, you know, noir and crime and all kinds of kinky and weird shit. But how did you develop this obsession with this dude?
It was kind of a joke, right?
Right.
That I, this is back in the days when you actually could use Twitter.
Right. Or Facebook, for that matter.
The circle jerk formerly known as Twitter.
Right.
And so I, just for fun, I had been noticing that this actor, Mads Mikkelsen, was tied up a lot.
Yeah.
You know, and I love bondage. I love bondage scenes in movies. I have always sort of, you know, kept like a casual record of my favorite bondage scenes. But here's an actor who, for some inexplicable reason, more than any other person, is tied up in almost every film.
So, and that, I said, lit your right. Fire right there. That was it.
Well, and so I just said, all right, so for fun, because I do these lists every now and then, I said, let me do a list of every single time that Mads Mikkelsen is tied up on screen. And I thought it was going to be like a little, just a fun thing. And it turned into this like epic, you know, I think we're now at 13 or
Holy
14
shit.
Incidents, which, you know, it is available to read on my blog. I have a
right.
detailed list of every time he is and isn't. Every time a new film comes out, I review whether or not there's a bondage scene in it. But so that's how it started. That's how it started. And then I'm working on a new project that I'm not at liberty to discuss at the moment.
It's not a full-sized Mads Mikkelsen with anatomically correct and a
oh, hell
gag
no.
ball,
hell,
is it?
Oh, hell, okay. Hell no. Let me just side note. Full-size sex dolls freak me the fuck out.
Okay. No, I
oh
hey.
My God. Huh. It's the uncanny valley. It's like, I can't with that. And you think like, there it is, just in your house, just like sitting there under a sheet, just hating you.
Oh.
And dreaming about getting revenge on you for all the things you've done to it.
Oh,
like,
my God.
I can't with sex dolls. I can't. That's like one of
yeah,
my
different strokes.
Little,
yeah. Where is his anatomically correct features? Because the last time I saw this doll, he was very proud.
He has a little suitcase. He has a little suitcase all filled with. He has like little BDSM.
Oh, that's right.
And he has various dildos and sex toys and, you know, all kinds of different things. But
so he's like that old Mr. Potato Head where you could put different
exactly,
things.
Exactly. Exactly. He has multiple sizes. Different
oh,
sizes
cool.
that he can put on depending on the situation, you know. But really, it just started off as a kind of little humorous joke, and then people started buying me things, you know, and then that's how I wound up with.
But now he's just like I said, he's like an unk. He's just an older guy in a tracksuit and some
yep,
kicks.
And,
I mean, that's so
well,
sad.
This is his like actual real actor, Mads Mikkelsen. Because
right.
This is the kind of shit that the real actor actually wears all the time. Yeah, you
know,
he is not a snappy dresser. I saw somebody once say that he dresses like a trash barrel with a Nike logo.
Oh my God, that's so sad.
But that's
that
just
so
not.
Sad.
I mean, yeah, he's not. I mean, he does
your
a lot
heroes
of modeling.
Are, you know, you get to know your heroes and you get crushed. I thought he
well,
was really kinky.
I do not know him personally, although I was told that our AI overlords who are taking over the universe with their fake information
right.
are now claiming that Mads Mikkelsen and I are like besties and like know each other and like share a love of film noir. And it's like,
yo,
why does
go
anybody
with
listen
it.
To these robots? Why?
Yeah.
They're clearly wrong, but nonetheless, 12-inch Mads is here.
Well, yeah, 12 inches is always better. In summer, sometimes, but not all the time. But what can we, let me just ask you this. I mean, this could be fun. It could be introspective. Your experiences, I mean, especially in, you know, Times Square and everything. I mean, you don't seem to make direct use of that in terms of plots, you know, as much as some people might. I mean, does it use it more as an inspiration for character and plot, or do you? Because I don't recall
Well,
any stories that. Okay, well, okay,
can
Peak Land.
recall this
Yeah, but
because
no, we're going to talk
Peopleland is
about that.
basically 100% exactly that.
Yeah, that's because that was going to be my next point. Is that in your novels, it's not a direct transfer, but Peak Land.
Well, I mean, Angel Dare is a sex worker. She,
Yeah.
works in the adult industry. Yeah, I mean, it's nothing. Peopleland is the closest that I've ever come to writing semi-autobiographical,
Okay,
or there
fair
are
enough, and
elements in
that's what I
here that
mean,
are
really.
based on my real life,
Yeah.
and very much like the nature of the peep boots, the way they work, the characters that I met, people in that world, all of this is it's more like a ransom note from cut up pieces of my life
Right.
rather than like an actual one-to-one like memoir of exactly
Okay.
what happened to me. But it contains, it's not a true story, but it contains a lot of truth.
I mean, therefore, was it easier to write? I mean, we'll take out the difference between writing prose and writing a script for a graphic novel, but was it easier conceptually to write, therefore, or was it just as tough as working on a novel?
It was easy. I mean, it isn't always easy to write characters that you don't know really well, or that you don't have things in common with them. I mean, the character that I wrote in Crime Inc. is a forensic pathologist
Right.
living in the 50s. It's like I have nothing, and a male character. I have nothing in common with that character, but yet, I was able to connect with them emotionally, and to kind of give him the voice that I felt that he should have. But for me, it's not so much that I want to impose my real life experience on my fiction. It's more that I'm not happy with the lack of honest, real sex worker voices in mystery fiction today. I mean, I have seen for so many years, decades, 100 years even, that sex workers are always furniture in a story.
Right.
They exist, they're catalysts. It's the sad daddy trope, right? Where a
Right.
woman is raped and murdered and a man feels manly feelings about that. And I'm sick of that. I mean, there are great examples of stories that are told using that as a trope, but those stories exist. We don't need more of that. But what you don't see is you don't see sex workers of all sorts, like me, like my friends and family, people that I love and grew up with. I don't see them reflected.
Right.
I don't just want to see tits bouncing in the background while two detectives have a serious conversation in a strip club.
Right.
I want to know who is that woman on the pole? Where's she going after this? What does she think about those two detectives? If you ever remember the old peep booths, they were kind of like two phone booths stuck together. So you have
Right.
the client on the one side and the dancer on the other side, and they have a phone where they could talk to each other. And for so long, the camera or the POV in fiction has been on the client side,
Right.
looking at the woman objectively. And one of the most important things to me as a writer is I wanted to flip the script. I wanted to turn the camera around
Right.
and have the POV characters be sex workers. And I think to me, that's much more important than, getting across my personal experience in fiction.
Well, let's play with that before we wrap up. Let's play with that a little bit. Okay, let's be daring. My safe word is cheeseburger, by the way. It's but it when we switch that around in the story, I mean, could you, one of the tropes is the sex worker is really this wound is this victim, and the audience, the pervert, the John, the person visiting. is some whack job is you know, or just so totally sad. I mean, I can speak from my own experience when when I was in school. I used to go to these things because I thought it was fucking fascinating, you know, and I didn't consider myself a loser. I mean, I can go all the time or a pervert, but I thought it was kind of cool to sit there and talk to somebody and they're like doing what they're doing and, you know, and just like being there and talking to them. But then again, I might be weird. I've gone to strip clubs just for the food. And you know, I this woman
I
actually
hope they had
did.
the sneeze guard,
Well,
you know,
no. I mean,
because
she
like
had, she was, t all she had on was a pair of heels. She did a little backflip, took my French fry, dipped it in some ketchup, ate it, and flipped right back again. And I was like, wow, that's a woman after my own heart. But,
really, but I just, for me, like food and nudity, unless you're at home with people with whom you are fluid bound, I don't necessarily want to share food in that environment. But that's neither here nor there, though. I'm going to turn this back on you, and I'm going to
Okay.
say that I'm hearing a lot from you, like, I feel weird. I feel like a pervert. I feel like I shouldn't be looking at feet. I feel like, and my question to you is, you know, sex work is real work, and people who hire sex workers are real people.
Right.
And they, in the same way that I don't feel that sex workers should be made to feel like there's something shameful about our work, I don't think that people who procure the services of sex workers should
Right.
be made to feel bad about that, provided, and this is a big proviso,
Right.
she's got to be over 18.
Right.
Because, I mean, such a huge percentage of, you know, the kind of street level sex work that we're seeing involves much younger people. And
And
that
violence.
in my
Yeah.
mind is not cool. But you know, if you want to pay an adult woman to make you smell her feet, like nobody should be embarrassed there.
Well, I
That's,
haven't
you
gone that
know,
far,
no,
but
but I mean,
you know.
I'm just trying to loosen the taboo and to say that, you know, if you have a need
Right.
that you are not able to fulfill, there is absolutely nothing wrong. Whether you want the girlfriend experience, you want a woman to listen to you talk about your job
Right.
and be really sympathetic and maybe give you a hug, you know, or if you want a woman to kick you in the balls, you know, like whatever it is that you're looking for, there's no shame in finding that with somebody on a professional basis, is what I'm saying.
Thank you for that validation. Now I can go out to the world. Excuse me. So let's
Happy to do it.
we're gonna wrap up, but let me ask you, what are you working on now? What fun stuff? What brings you joy? What pisses you off? What, you know,
Well,
just to
I have a
wrap
top
up.
secret. I have a top secret project that
Right.
is in the works, and it's a real left turn at Albuquerque for me. It's kind of different and interesting. So I love topic crushes. I get these topic crushes where I need to know every single thing about X or Y. And so I'm kind of down a new rabbit hole with some interesting ideas that I'm kind of enamored of and obsessed with. But I've also got a couple of potential collaborative projects that are, you know, on the back burner, not the least of which being a project with my beloved sometime co-author Gary.
Cool.
We have a project that we have been kind of, you know, tinkering with in our spare time for quite a while now, and we keep saying, oh, you know, we gotta, yeah, that's a great idea, we gotta drag that one out and, you know, see if we can make it get up and walk. But we haven't yet. But you know, it's someday,
Well,
someday.
let me ask you this then. Would you ever do just a standalone novel that didn't have kind of a retro pulpy cover? Something, you know, with flowers or teddy bears or a cup of tea with honey?
I don't think that I would write a cozy because I don't feel qualified. And that isn't because I think cozies are contemptible and people who read them are stupid. Let me be clear on that.
Oh, no.
You
Oh,
know,
no.
and I feel the same way about like romance. Like, I don't think I would be a good romance writer because I just, my brain doesn't go down those lines of storytelling. So I tend to stay with, you know, the genres that I like. But the project that I'm working on now has a standalone novel attached to it. It's bigger than that,
Okay.
but it is a standalone novel, and it is not like a hard case crime novel. It's something totally different.
Okay. Yeah. Because I mean, there are a lot of, you know, we're supposedly the nicest people in literature, but there are a lot of people in our, you know, in our crime genre who kind of got big egos, and a lot of them think that they can write, if they're starting off, you know, with thrillers, they can write cozies, and you know, and I guess their agents tell them that, and they can pull the audiences. But it's refreshing to see somebody who says, "Look, I'm going to stay in my fucking lane because this is my lane. This is my brain work."
And it isn't because I don't. I mean, I'm a professional tie-in writer. I mean, I've written Snakes on Motherfucking Plane. You know, I can do the job.
Yeah.
If I was hired to write a romance novel, I would do the job, and I'm a good enough writer that I would be proud of what I did, but it doesn't float my boat. It doesn't get me off. It doesn't, it's not my thing. So because you can do something doesn't necessarily mean you want it.
Thank you. And let me just end with this. We get, for 2 seconds, just explain the whole Snakes on a Plane reference. I should have brought that in.
All right. I mean, there really isn't much to explain. I was hired by a tie-in company, a publisher, to write the novel version of the movie Snakes on a Plane. And the difference between novelizations and tie-ins is that a novelization is where you take a written, already existing script and you turn it into a novel. You kind of puff it up and you make it to be 95,000 words. And a tie-in is where you take an existing character like Batman or whatever, and you write more adventures of that character.
Like Star Wars stuff, yeah.
Exactly. That would be a tie-in. So you're taking those characters and you're giving them new adventures. And Snakes on a Plane was a novelization. And we went through all this crazy rigmarole because there was so much viral craziness surrounding that film that, like, when I had to, the original script that I had to work off of was called Pacific Air Flight 121.
Yeah.
And the Sam Jackson character was white. And the famous line was not there. So
yeah, that was everything.
I had to go through all this crazy rigmarole to get a script that contained that line.
Right.
And so this is New Line, right? And I was living in LA at the time. I could walk to New Line and get the script, but no. They had to snail mail the script to England, to my publisher in England, who then snail mail it back to me in LA. It was like this, you know, when you have evidence in a crime, it's the chain of command.
Chain of custody,
everybody has to sign to have, I'm going to take custody of the script, and I swear that I'm not going to show it to anyone. So we
show
went through
business.
A lot of craziness. Show
Bullshit,
business.
Yes.
But it was fun. I enjoyed it.
If somebody had told me, if I come from another planet and I saw that movie, and I said somebody, and they said somebody else who actually writes prose wrote that, I would either think it would be you, Gary, or Gar Anthony Haywood. Those are the only three people I would think that would come up with that line.
Again, I was already given the whole story.
Like, oh, I know, but I'm saying if you had done it from scratch, I would say,
exactly.
One of these three people came up with that line because it's brilliant.
I will say this. I actually believe that line was ad-libbed.
Yeah, it was. It was.
By the actor. But I just recently recorded some extra material for the new DVD release of Snakes on a Plane. So if you're interested, keep your eye out for that release. It has some extensive interviews with me talking about Snakes on a Plane.
Well, we are going to wrap up. And Krista, thank you. And, you know, or should I say thank you, mistress, or something like that?
Yes, you should.
Thank you, mistress, for allowing my low self to interview you. You know, please, of course, dig your high heel into my ear. I don't really do that. That was an ad lib. I just made that up. You know, so that's not a confession.
Sam Jackson has nothing to worry about.
Right. Don't leave your day job. But thank you so much for this. This has been a real pleasure and very, very educational, because I wanted people to, I didn't want people to think it's going to be like a perverted gab fest, which would have suited me fine too. But I mean, I wanted, you know, and there's, yeah, this little Mads with his smooth crotch, sadly. But I just want to thank you. There it is. Oh my God, that's so sad. And no butthole either.
Nothing, no.
All right, I want to thank you, little Mads, and your wonderful body of work and, you know, just wonderful heart and personality today. And we're going to, this is going to go out on Incandescent Radio Network, on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, and iHeartRadio. And of course, on my site, on YouTube, the video will be on YouTube, and my site, chrischambersnoir.com. Thank you so much, everybody.
Thank you both. This was fascinating, enlightening, educational. You are listening to Chris Chambers Noir, the show on Apple TV, Spotify, on Apple, Spotify, and all the things that Chris said. I'm Hope Katz Gibbs, proud producer of the show. Krista, you are fucking badass. Thank you. We'll see you all soon.